Welcome to Life, Love, and Light. I'm Veronica Mary Rolfe, and in this fourth season of our podcasts, we're examining the topic of resurrection, Christ's resurrection, and our own. We will also be considering how we might live resurrected lives right now, even in the midst of our personal sufferings and our fears, as well as the stark reality of a terrible war. This series of podcasts is drawn from my recent award-winning book, Living Resurrected Lives, What It Means and Why It Matters, co-authored by my daughter, Dr. Eva Natanya. Last week, we discussed the epilogue to the Gospel of John, in which the risen Jesus appeared to seven disciples as they were returning from a frustrating night of fishing on Lake Tiberias. This resurrection appearance included another miraculous catch of fish, a breakfast with Jesus on the beach, and a poignant conversation between the Lord and Peter, in which the disciple who denied Jesus three times was given the opportunity to affirm his love three times. And then we examined repeated attempts at alternative interpretations of Christ's appearances that have challenged faith in his bodily resurrection. Most Christians probably do believe that Jesus really died, that his tomb was empty, and that he came back to life. But how many Christians have really considered in what way he came back to life? Was it a resuscitation? Only a spiritual resurrection of his soul? Or a vision of a different Jesus altogether? Are the resurrection appearances merely pious legends or pre-scientific myths? Did the disciples truly believe that Jesus had risen in a glorified body? Or did they simply feel the continuing presence of the Lord in their midst? Does the New Testament language of the evangelists and of Paul really mean what it says? Or was the crucial resurrection event what happened to the disciples and not what happened to Jesus at all? Or does Jesus only live on in the salvific preaching of the church? So last week we delved into these and other modern and postmodern interpretations. And then we considered the earliest creedal formulations in the four canonical Gospels, in the letters of St. Paul, and in the Acts of the Apostles, in order to discover, or perhaps rediscover, the bedrock of our faith, what Christ's resurrection really means. Now this week, I want to discuss a whole different category of objections to Christ's bodily resurrection. I want to examine persistent psychological theories put forth as to just what the disciples actually saw and what they heard, and the state of mind in which they experienced the appearances. These objections are brought forth by modern and postmodern theologians and psychologists who consider the resurrection appearances to have been merely altered states of consciousness. Now, why must we consider all these objections? Because it is crucial that we understand the arguments and the flaws in these various theories, so that when the bedrock foundation of resurrection belief is challenged, we're able to answer the objections with clarity and conviction. And perhaps when we ourselves question Christian faith in bodily resurrection, we need to be very clear and completely certain that the ancient creed, "I believe in the resurrection of the body and life everlasting," really does mean what it says. especially in a time of ongoing pandemic and brutal war, and the inconceivable suffering and death of soldiers and civilians, and the desperation of millions of fleeing refugees. We need the reality of Christ's resurrection to reassure us every hour of every day that nothing we undergo will be lost. All our sufferings are being taken up into Christ's own sufferings on the cross, and all are being transformed and glorified in the fullness of Christ's resurrection, and someday our own. Without that grounding in resurrection faith, we may lose hope. Thus, we must continually deepen our faith in the truth of resurrection so that we live in its redemptive reality and find our peace in its promise, even amidst the crises of our daily lives. So now to examine some further objections that are brought against the reality of bodily resurrection. Some scholars have argued that even though the first disciples believed that they had seen Jesus in the flesh, these experiences must be categorized as visions, hallucinations, or self-delusions. They consider that the disciples merely experienced an apparition of Jesus while in an altered state of consciousness. They could not have been physical encounters with the real Jesus. They were only visions. Well, to begin, we must ask just what are visions? According to many psychologists, visions are usually uplifting experiences, accompanied by light and pleasant feelings, increased joy and love, sometimes even a euphoric trance. Visions may appear to an individual in an ordinary state of consciousness or as part of an altered consciousness, such as an out-of-body transportation, spiritual ecstasy, near-death experiences, or a mystical state of union. Now, throughout the Gospels, whenever a person experiences a dream, a vision, or a trance, the text itself clearly differentiates this altered state of consciousness from an ordinary state of consciousness. However, as one psychologist commented, quote, such descriptions of altered states are almost entirely absent in the resurrection narratives, with the lone exception of Luke 24:23, which refers to the women seeing a vision of angels at the tomb. So quite deliberately, the evangelists all depicted the resurrection events as occurring in everyday space-time, when the recipients were in an ordinary state of consciousness. As we have seen, all the canonical Gospels report clearly that the tomb was empty and the corpse was gone. Any stranger arriving on the scene could have attested to these same basic facts. There was no need to portray the discovery of this observable situation as having occurred in an altered state of consciousness or in a vision. Notably, according to psychologists, a vision, quote, is not the same as an image or a fantasy in which one sees something in one's mind mentally. Visions are seen outside oneself. So except for the sudden appearances and departures of Jesus on a road, in the upper room, or on the beach, the actual resurrection appearances seem less astonishing than one might expect from a visionary or ecstatic experience. Jesus does not make himself manifest in blazing light. He does not levitate. He does not work miracles or grant healings. And again, there is no indication in the texts that what the disciples saw was to be understood by anyone as a vision. Quite the contrary. Matthew, Luke, and John all describe Jesus doing the very things he usually did, just as he had done them during his earthly ministry. He stands, walks, reclines, blesses, teaches, eats, cooks, and speaks in a familiar human voice. Only Luke describes Jesus as having been, quote, carried up into heaven at the ascension before the eyes of the assembled group in what seems like a supernatural experience. However, in context, it seems that in this passage, Luke created a distinctly symbolic scene to indicate that Jesus had indeed returned to the Father. And notably, some ancient authorities do not even include this phrase in their texts. Now, other contemporary scholars are convinced, and try to convince their readers, that the resurrection appearances were a clear case of mass hallucination. So just what is a hallucination? Dr. Dennis Gerstein defines it, quote, "A hallucination is the experience of a sight, sound, smell, or taste in a situation in which there is no verifiable physical cause of or evidence for that experience." So a hallucination is further defined as a false perception produced by the senses that seem real to the observer, but that lacks any external verifiable reality. Quote, "A psychotic hallucination is a projection from one's unconscious mind into the outside world." According to psychologists, hallucinations may involve one or more of the senses, and they're more common to certain personality types. They seem to be more frequent in females than in males, and are more likely to appear to older, grieving adults. Modern psychiatry has categorized hallucination as either, quote, "a disturbance of brain structure, a disturbance of neurotransmitters, or as an emergence of the unconscious into consciousness." And furthermore, quote, "visual hallucinations can be the result of all three processes. Given the interplay among disturbances of brain anatomy, brain chemistry, prior experiences, and psychodynamic meaning." It is essential to note that, like optical illusions or visions or dreams, hallucinations are produced by the individual mind and brainwaves of the perceiver. Thus, they are non-transferable from one person to another. Nonetheless, some scholars still insist that all the disciples, men and women alike, had the same hallucinatory experience of the risen Jesus at the same time and in the same place. Based on modern scientific research, this is highly unlikely. In fact, totally improbable. Every one of the disciples in the upper room could not have experienced the same hallucination of Jesus in the same way and at the same time. These men and women were of different ages, backgrounds, personality types, and emotional susceptibilities. And they all had different minds. Granted, they had all suffered immense shock and grief at the death of Jesus, and they felt fear for their own lives. Nevertheless, for each of them, and we have no idea how many were there in addition to the 11 mentioned in the Gospels, for each of them to have the same experience of Jesus in a mass hallucination, and that on several occasions, stretches the limits of scientific credulity. One clinical psychologist who has studied the professional literature exhaustively writes that he has, quote, yet to find a single documented case of a group hallucination, that is, an event for which more than one person purportedly shared in a visual or other sensory perception where there was clearly no external referent. Still another possibility arises. Did each disciple have a different hallucination, occurring at precisely the same time and in the same place, and yet did they all produce the same conviction that Jesus was standing there, risen from the dead? This contention is equally implausible. Theologian Michael Lacona responds, quote, all of the resurrection narratives written shortly after the oral tradition suggest that this was not the case, but that all of the disciples, as opposed to only some of those present, experienced the same phenomenon as opposed to experiences of a different phenomenon. In other words, the experiences of the risen Jesus were of such a nature that the disciples believed they had participated in the same event. Now, a most exotic explanation for the group appearances is based on the idea of Peter's having had a psychotic incident of seeing Jesus. One New Testament scholar, Gert Ludemann, contends that the apostle was so stricken by his betrayal of Jesus and then by Christ's scandalous death that he became a victim of severe, quote, self-deception. His emotional and mental anguish so completely disrupted his ability to judge the real from the imaginary that his mind became unbalanced. Ludemann argues that Peter hallucinated a vision of Jesus because he needed to believe the Lord had risen from the dead to forgive him for his sin in person and to relieve his extreme state of guilt and mourning. Moreover, the power of Peter's self-delusion was so great that the other disciples, in a kind of chain reaction, shared his fantasy and saw Jesus too. Quote, by a bold, if unconscious, leap, Peter entered the world of his wishes. As a result, he saw Jesus, and thus made it possible for the other disciples to see Jesus as well. Thus, according to Ludemann, an individual hallucination became a mass hallucination. Does this seem plausible? Granted, many of us may have experienced extraordinary sensory phenomena as part of a grieving process associated with the death of a loved one, and this is perfectly normal. We may have had vivid dreams in which the person appeared to us as real as in life. Even while awake, we may have, quote, heard the dead person speak to us in a recognizable voice. We may have, quote, seen a vision of the deceased standing before us as if truly present. However, in our normal state of awareness, we knew that what we dreamed, imagined, or experienced as a spiritual presence was radically different from actually seeing our loved one bodily alive in the room, sitting down together with us to share a meal and engage in conversation. Nor did those around us experience the exact same dream, vision, or sense of spiritual presence that we did. Yet, as the psychotic hallucination theory goes, because of the disciples' naturally superstitious inclination to believe in the appearance of ghosts and angels and demons, Peter's own conviction that he had really seen Jesus resulted in a, quote, group fantasy that had both audible and visual aspects. Such a shared hallucination, quote, assured them of forgiveness for their desertion of Jesus in his time of need. According to this theory, the appearance to James and the more than 500 brothers and sisters at one time, as cited in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, was also a form of mass ecstasy. In addition, this theory maintains that the later post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to Paul was another classic case of self-deception because of Paul's mental conflicts about his persecution of Jewish Christians. In short, this hypothesis states that all the resurrection appearances were merely, quote, subjective delusions arising in gullible disciples as a result of severe, quote, psychological disorders. Is any of this plausible? Had grief and guilt rendered all the disciples psychotic and therefore completely disconnected from reality, unable to tell the ghostly from the bodily, the abnormal from the normal? In essence, were the appearances, whether to two women or to more than 500 at a time, simply a form of group fantasy or mass hysteria? In answer, scholar Dale Allison considers such conjectures, quote, just that, conjectures. They do not constitute knowledge. In recent decades, contemporary historians have been more leery than their predecessors of the viability of reconstructing and then analyzing the psychohistories of men and women long dead. In other words, we must beware of the pitfalls of psychoanalyzing people from another time and culture who've been dead for 2,000 years. Moreover, the wishful thinking alluded to in this theory does not fit the mindset of the women on their way to the tomb. As we've discussed in a recent podcast, from the scriptural account, these women had no expectation that Jesus would or could rise from the dead, and no hope of seeing anything other than a corpse. It would not have occurred to any of them to engage in wishful thinking or to succumb to a dreamlike state of self-delusion that Jesus was truly alive. Neither did the two disciples on their way to Emmaus expect to meet a resurrected Jesus. Nor did Peter and the beloved disciple or any of the other disciples expect to encounter Jesus. After Jesus' death, they were all simply devastated. They did not anticipate that they would ever see Jesus again. The disciples did not remember, or else did not believe Jesus' predictions that he would rise from the dead. And even when they did see Jesus alive and in a transformed human body, they still had trouble believing it was truly he. They were full of fear and doubt that it was really Jesus. They themselves questioned what they saw and heard, precisely because they did not trust illusions, visions, or altered states of reality. These disciples do not seem like typical hypnotic subjects, nor do we have any evidence that they were prone to self-delusion. The rough and rugged fisherman and the former tax collector, as well as the down-to-earth, determined women who had followed Jesus all the way from Galilee, these were not your typical candidates to become ecstatic visionaries. By all accounts, the disciples were much too naturally skeptical, and yes, disbelieving for that. Finally, let us recall that no one in first century Judaism, neither the original disciples, nor Saul, who became the Apostle Paul, nor the later evangelists, had ever anticipated that any individual, even the Messiah, would rise from the dead before the last judgment at the end of the world. It was simply unthinkable. So if Jesus' closest followers had no expectation that Jesus would rise from the dead, how could their minds have concocted the kind of wishful thinking necessary to project such a, quote, collective hallucination? Biblical scholar Gerard O'Connell writes, quote, "Hence, hallucinating disciples, projecting their prior beliefs, could not have claimed that Jesus had been raised and glorified in anticipation of a universal resurrection of the dead, which was still to come. There was no such prior belief to be projected." This hallucination theory also does not explain the post-resurrection appearance to the man named Saul on his way to Damascus a few years after the appearances to the disciples in the upper room in Jerusalem, on a mountain in Galilee or a beach by Lake Tiberias. At that time, Saul did not even know Peter and the other apostles. Thus he could not have been part of a, quote, chain reaction hysteria. Of all people, Saul had no mental predisposition for wanting to see a resurrected Jesus. In fact, by rounding up early disciples of Jesus and delivering them to the Sanhedrin to be put on trial and condemned to death, Saul showed himself to be an ardent persecutor of this man Jesus and all those associated with him. To Saul, Jesus was a blasphemer, an apostate from the Torah, and a threat to established Judaism, who had deserved to die. So must his followers. Saul was convinced that such heresy must be stamped out. He certainly would not have projected a vision of Christ because he wanted forgiveness for persecuting Christ's disciples. He thought he was serving God by killing Christians. When we're considering the resurrection appearances, we are not talking about phenomena that can be examined in a systematic way from the perspective of historical, psychological, or biological investigation, at least as these disciplines are currently understood. These experiences were recounted precisely as unique and extraordinary events. They were at once shocking, exhilarating, overwhelming, and empowering. They produced fear, joy, doubt, and belief all at once. They could not then and cannot now be explained by merely human methods of investigation, psychological or otherwise. They could only be experienced by those privileged to experience them. For us in the 21st century, they can only be pondered with a sense of wonder, humility, and awe. It is well attested that the disciples were willing to suffer torture and die brutal deaths as a result of their personal conviction that Jesus had truly risen from the dead. They had no doubt that they had seen Jesus with their own eyes and heard him with their own ears. Indeed, as one scholar says, quote, "The disciples' conviction that they had seen the risen Christ is part of historical bedrock, facts known past doubting." Those who witnessed the risen Jesus could not deny him because, in a profound way, they had been totally transformed by his resurrection and had already become like him. And so by following in his footsteps, through preaching, forgiving sins, working miracles, and bearing witness in public that the risen Jesus was Lord and Messiah, they knew perfectly well what the consequences were likely to be. They would most likely have to become martyrs for their faith. They had no illusions, no delusions, only convictions. Dr. Lacona writes, quote, "The case is strong that they did not willfully lie about the appearances of the risen Jesus. Liars make poor martyrs." Everyone else who has ever believed, hoped, and endured persecution and death for the sake of Jesus Christ has done so based on the convincing witness of these first disciples, men and women. And throughout the ages, Christians have not seen the risen Jesus, but they know in whom they have believed. In 1 Peter, we hear, quote, "Although you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and rejoice with an indescribable and glorious joy, for you are receiving the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls." So in conclusion, what can we believe? The following facts have been generally agreed upon by historical scholarship, as well as by the vast majority of biblical and theological scholars. First, that Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried. Second, that soon after his death, certain followers of Jesus experienced bodily appearances of the same person they had known in their lifetime, and that these experiences convinced them that God had raised Jesus from the dead. Third, that the disciples who had been mournful, fearful, and doubtful after the crucifixion became joyful, courageous, believing, and empowered to preach the gospel at whatever cost. And fourth, that within a few years of Jesus' death, Saul of Tarsus, a fanatical persecutor of Christians, had a post-resurrection experience of the risen Christ that led him to become the foremost preacher of the good news of the gospel. There is no explanation for such a radical transformation in the lives of these people other than a firm belief in the reality of Christ's resurrection. As philosopher Stephen Davis writes, quote, "The most plausible explanation of these facts, say those who believe in the resurrection, is that Jesus did indeed rise from the dead and show himself to the disciples. It does not seem sensible to claim that the Christian church, a spiritual movement with the vitality to change the world, was started by charlatans or dupes. If the disciples knew that Jesus was not really risen, they were charlatans. If they believed he was risen, when in fact he was not, they were dupes." Of course, we must acknowledge that it was not until after his death, when Christ showed himself to them as being resurrected from the dead, that the disciples finally got it, that they came to the realization of who Jesus really was. If God had revealed bodily resurrection in this man, then Jesus must indeed be the long-awaited Messiah. In that recognition, the disciples were radically changed, all of them. And even though they did not understand at first what had happened, the women who came to the tomb were empowered to tell the disciples what they'd seen. And likewise, once the disciples were transformed by the descent of the Holy Spirit, they were emboldened to come out of their hiding place and bear witness to Jesus as the Messiah. And they knew, given the political situation, that they would be arrested and condemned like Jesus, which eventually many of them were. In conclusion, nothing in the Gospels makes any sense unless Jesus of Nazareth was resurrected, and precisely in that unexpected way showed himself to be the long-awaited Messiah, the Anointed One of God. Even considering the authority of his preaching about the kingdom of God, his miraculous healings of the deaf, the dumb, the blind, the lame, the leprous, his power to forgive sins and transform lives, his willingness to suffer and die as a criminal to demonstrate the divine compassion that enters into the pain of all humankind. Even considering all that, unless Jesus had truly risen from the dead in a transformed body, the entire story might have been dramatic and inspiring, but ultimately a tragic fiction. Unless Jesus had risen from the dead, his extraordinary actions as a human being would still not have shown him to be divine. He would not have revealed what it means to be the Son of God incarnate. He would not have shown what it means to conquer completely the evil of sin and the finality of death. Without the resurrection, there is no climax and no metamorphosis to the story of salvation. Belief in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ is the most reasonable and finally the only comprehensive explanation for everything written in the Gospels. It is also the only explanation for Christian hope that death is not the end of life. As Christ speaks in the Gospel of John, "And this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day. This indeed is the will of my Father, that all who see the Son and believe in him may have eternal life, and I will raise them up on the last day. As mentioned at the beginning, these podcasts are based on themes from my newest book, Living Resurrected Lives, What It Means and Why It Matters, which is co-authored by my daughter, Dr. Eva Natanya. And this book won the 2021 Catholic Media Association Book Award for Contemporary Spirituality. If you would like information about Living Resurrected Lives, please visit my website, veronicamaryrolfe.com. The book is available in paperback, as an ebook from the publisher, Wipf & Stock, and also, of course, from Amazon and other bookstores worldwide. Next week, we will go in depth into St. Paul's teachings on the resurrected body. In his letters to the Corinthians and Galatians, Paul dealt with the issues concerning the resurrection that are still being debated today. Was Jesus resurrected bodily? Will our own bodies be resurrected? And if so, what kind of body will it be? Physical or spiritual? Paul used both vigorous argument and evocative metaphor to make the concept of bodily resurrection abundantly clear for the newly converted Greeks, and indeed for generations to come. However, like many postmodern people, these early Christians had serious resistance to belief in the resurrection of the body. We will examine in detail how Paul dealt with these controversial theories, and how he illuminated Christian understanding of bodily resurrection for generations. You won't want to miss this very heated debate. So I hope you will register for notifications of these ongoing podcasts, and be sure to tell your friends about them too. So until next week, I wish you all the blessings of divine life, love, and light.